Good evening and welcome to the final presentation in this our 12th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague over to the right here, Peggy Wright, with help from our webmaster taking pictures, Hai Wong Wan. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shabin Melky. Our speaker tonight is a native of Colorado, but spent most of his childhood in Georgia and Rhode Island. And growing up, he said he wanted to be a professional football player, but realized at an early age that other career paths needed to be explored. He graduated from high school in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and received an appointment to the United States Naval Academy, from where he graduated with a degree in economics. He spent the 6 years that followed on active duty with the Navy as a surface warfare officer, serving on a destroyer in Charleston, South Carolina, followed by a tour at Norwich University in Vermont as a naval ROTC instructor. He began working for Fruit of the Loom in 1999 and has served in a variety of management roles and is presently the Senior Vice President of Corporate Strategy and Business Development. In October of 2013, Fruit of the Loom announced the launch of a new brand campaign and platform titled Start Happy, which drew major media attention and was even reported in Broadway World. Our speaker was quoted as saying, "We know the morning is a powerful thing. It can set the tone for the entire day. A great fitting pair of underwear can make you feel like you can do anything." Here to tell us about that campaign and a lot more, Scott Green.
That was a great introduction. I guess I'll start with a confession. That quote you just shared with everyone, you'll learn that I plagiarized it, because I'm going to show a video from our advertising agency that says kind of the same thing. So thank you very much for allowing me to be here this evening. This is something I've been very, very excited about. As I look out, I'm kind of particularly enthusiastic with the kind of the multi-generational audience that we have. I see a lot of young faces, and I hope you guys are here voluntarily, and it's not for class credit or anything like that. I also had the pleasure of meeting, I'm certain, the first 90-year-old that's still working. That was quite an honor, and it reminds me of a story in doing research for this presentation. There was an article that was in the local paper here back in 1961 talking about our Church Street location and the many kind of employee benefits. And one of the benefits is that when workers became of a certain age, a more senior age, and started collecting Social Security, they allowed them to back off of their hours, but not necessarily retire. So I hope you get to at least have some input on how many hours you work. But it's a real pleasure to be here. I will, another confession on the front end, I am not a historian, but I do have a real passion for the work of our company, and I have a real passion for this community. And so I think the way that these two passions have come together was really kind of a sweet spot for me to kind of dig in and learn a little bit, frankly. And I had a lot of fun doing it. I hope you enjoyed it as well. I just want to recognize one person before I get started, and that's one of my colleagues, Lacey Wells, who's sitting kind of close to the back. Lacey joined Fruit of the Loom about 5 years ago, a proud WKU grad, and she was hired to start pulling our archives together. We realized that we had a really rich history, but nobody had really come in and pulled these moments together in a way that could start helping us tell a story. And there is no way in the world I could have made this presentation or pulled this information together tonight if it weren't for Lacey. So I also told her if she showed up, she was going to get a lot of the hard questions if I needed to kind of pull out a lifeline. So glad you're here, Lacey, and you can't leave until I'm done, okay? So let me go ahead and get started. And really what I wanted to do is kind of tell this story in three different ways. I'm going to attempt to tell a company history that's almost 100 years old, and I'm going to try to do that very, very briefly. And then we're going to talk a little bit about brand building, and specifically the building of the Fruit of the Loom brand. And then I'm going to wrap it up and talk a little bit about our company today. So there will be kind of three chapters to this presentation. I'll move through most of the material. If there's something that really isn't kind of setting well with you, feel free to kind of raise your hand and let me know, and I'll make sure that I wrap up in time to answer whatever questions you may have at the end. So, sound like a plan? All right, here we go. So we're going to start our story with a man by the name of Jacob Goldfarb. Actually went by Jack Goldfarb. And he started Union Underwear back in 1926. He was born in Poland and migrated to the U.S., into New York City in 1906. And at a very young age, his mom actually sent him over to live with his older married sister in New York. And I think he started fending for himself at a pretty early age. So he was he would make money delivering telegrams for the Western Union. He was a Wall Street runner delivering stocks, and found his first job in the garment industry, working in the garment industry in New York for an underwear manufacturer. And that's where he first started learning the trade. Like most in his generation, he went off to war and served as a quartermaster during World War I. And when the war was over, came back to New York and went right back to work for that same underwear manufacturer up in the garment industry, or in the garment district. That company went under fairly quickly, and somehow he found his way to Indianapolis, Indiana, and went to work for the Dries family, making what we call union suits. Does anybody know what a union suit is? Okay, I'll share with you a picture of a union suit here in just a second. And what was interesting is with the Dries family and their business, they didn't have a manufacturing location per se, so they actually outsourced a lot of the production to multiple convents in and around the Indianapolis area. And that seemed to serve them well for a while, but at some point, for whatever reason, they decided that it was time to sell the company. So they sold the company to Jack Goldfarb, and he bought this company in 1926 and formed the Union Underwear Company. So that was the start of Union Underwear. And from day one, he had a motto, and that was that he wanted to sell really, really high-quality product, but at a low price. He felt like that's something that he could do effectively. So he coined the term the best for the least. And I think you'll see as I go through this presentation, that positioning, if you will, has really stood the test of time. So one man, one product. This is kind of laying on a flat wall, what we call a union suit. And I think for the guys in the audience, we should all be very thankful that this particular product somehow didn't find its way to the 21st century. But this was a single undergarment, and it was made of muslin fabric, which was kind of a lighter cotton fabric. And what Goldfarb realized is that if he could specialize in this one product and make it really, really well and make it at a high volume, therefore being able to control the price, that would be his competitive advantage in the marketplace. This whole idea of specialization, which seems kind of obvious to us today, but back when Goldfarb started the company, it was a fairly novel idea. So that was his idea. His one product was going to be this union suit, and again, he was going to try to produce a lot of it and try to do it very, very well, but try to keep the price down. That became his business model, if you will. So how did Union Underwear end up in the bluegrass here in South Central Kentucky? Well, the first move was back in 1932, and Goldfarb was doing a decent job of kind of building his business in Indianapolis, but he recognized that he needed a more stable labor force, and he needed more production. So he opened up a plant in Frankfort, Kentucky in 1932 and actually hired 400 employees, again, still focusing on this union suit, but also introducing a second item. And today, and being in the underwear business, we have a lot of different styles, so it's actually much more complicated than everybody realizes. But the second garment that he started to make was a side-tied button front boxer short. And if you were to see one of these, it's a much more complicated garment than what we have today, but it was kind of a deviation from the union suit, and I think it was a good move for Goldfarb, because again, the industry was kind of moving away from this union suit. So that was the first bluegrass, if you will, plant in Frankfurt, and he was also very focused on providing a good work environment for his employees. One of the benefits at the time, and this is a benefit that really lived up to just a couple of years ago, was he offered free milk for his employees. So this picture down in the lower right hand corner, you can see the ladies, they're on a break, and everybody's there passing out free milk. And you know, during the war years, it was hard to get your hands on quality milk, and this is something that, particularly for a lot of women that were pregnant, they wanted to make sure that they were getting the calcium that they needed. So union took it upon themselves to provide milk. And it's in doing a little bit of research, even in the Church Street facility here in Bowling Green, as late as 1961, the group there was actually going through 35 to 40 gallons a day of milk, and which I think also became quite expensive for us, and maybe part of the reason that we're not doing it to this day, but still a nice benefit for the employees at the time. And then in 1941, we opened our first facility here in Bowling Green. So it was down on Church Street. It was termed the Derby, and Derby underwear was a brand that Goldfarb was trying to build at the time. I'm not sure if it was influenced by the Kentucky Derby in Louisville, but I assume that maybe there was a connection there. So this operation was affectionately termed the Derby, and from the start employed about 800 employees and became really a strong foundation for Union Underwear's overall production. So any questions so far? So we're in the bluegrass. Part of the story that we're really proud of is during the war years, 1941 to 1945, Union Underwear actually dedicated 85% of its production capacity to support the war effort. Every soldier, sailor, and Marine, as part of their standard issue, was given 6 undergarments. And in total, we provided over 50 million undergarments during those 4 years. We were hands down the largest supplier of underwear to support the war effort, and actually received some commendations from the procurement departments of both the Department of the Army and the Navy for our work during that period. Like a lot of companies, after the war was over, we were in expansion mode, and Goldfarb certainly had big aspirations to build the company and continue to grow the company. In 1948, we opened our first fully integrated, what we call a vertical integrated plant in Campbellsville, Kentucky. And by vertical integration, what we mean is that from knitting to bleaching to dyeing to cutting to sewing, all of those operations were done within one building. And even today, we consider ourselves to be a vertical manufacturer, but we don't do all those operations in one place. We have enough volume where we have different facilities that specialize in each of those functions. But back then, to be able to do everything in one location was a really big deal. And Campbellsville was that first vertically integrated facility for us. Also in 1950, we doubled the capacity of the Bowling Green Church Street facility. So as again, we were building more and more capacity right here in Bowling Green. Throughout the 50s and 60s, again, Goldfarb had very strong growth aspirations and continued to open up facilities throughout the Southeast. By 1961, we actually had 24 independent facilities throughout the Southeast. And again, this was just additional capacity and production to support the growing demand for the Union Underwear product. So it was quite a growth journey, really coming through the war and even moving into the 50s and 60s. One of the bigger moves for the company in the 1960s and again, excuse me, 1955, is to continue to fund the growth aspirations. Goldfarb decided to sell Union Underwear, and he sold it to the Philadelphia and Reading Holding Company. So it was a new conglomerate that was the kind of the holding company for multiple operations. And what that allowed Goldfarb to have is the capital to really go out and invest in more expansion. So he sold the company in 1955, and then through some additional consolidation, the company was resold to Northwest Industries in 1968. Goldfarb stayed on as the CEO until 1968, and actually remained on as the chairman of the board until 1973. So you think about that, from 1926 all the way to 1973, this was the guy that was at the helm of the company, which is pretty kind of historical in and of itself. But what you're about to learn is we actually had another leader that his tenure at the lead helm spanned just about the same amount of time. Okay, so part of what's everything I've talked about so far is Union Underwear, and I haven't even mentioned Fruit of the Loom. So let me just give you a little bit of a snippet of how these two companies came together, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about the Fruit of the Loom brand here in just a minute. So three key dates I want to share with you, and the first is 1938. So as Jack Goldfarb was trying to build Union Underwear, and he was trying to develop brands like the Derby brand that I mentioned earlier, the one thing that he was missing was a nationally recognized brand. So he engaged in a licensing agreement with the Knight brothers, who had developed the Fruit of the Loom brand after developing some capacity through the textile mills of New England. And he and Goldfarb engaged in it. He signed a 25-year exclusive licensing agreement with the Knight brothers for the Fruit of the Loom brand. So that was kind of the first connection with Union Underwear and Fruit of the Loom. In 1961, so about 6 years after Philadelphia and Reading acquired Union Underwear, they were able to actually buy the brand outright from the Knight brothers. So Fruit of the Loom and Union Underwear both became part of this holding company, Philadelphia and Reading, in 1961. And then in 1981, after Union Underwear became part of Northwest Industries, then the team at Union Underwear worked a deal with Northwest Industries where Fruit of the Loom, the Fruit of the Loom licensing group, became an independent or a wholly owned subsidiary of Union Underwear. And that's really the arrangement of Fruit of the Loom and Union Underwear that we kind of recognize today. I'm going to come back to the Fruit of the Loom brand here in just a second. So really what that does is that sets us up for what I would like to describe as the John Holland era. And hopefully, I know there's some folks in the room that know Mr. Holland. I had the distinct honor to work directly with him for about 7 years, and actually saw him at church on Sunday. So it was kind of nice in pulling this together. His mind is incredible, and his retention of facts is like nobody else's I've ever met. So I was able to actually run some of this stuff by him and do a little fact checking with him, Lacey. And he, so far, I think he thinks we're pretty much on track. So let me tell you a little bit about John Holland. He was born in Scottsville, Kentucky, not too far from here, and he actually started with Union Underwear in 1961. He was hired on as a traffic manager, but I don't think he stayed in that role for very long. Over the course of the next, we'll say 5 to 10 years, he was promoted to be our vice president of purchasing and planning. And then by the early part of 1975, so he'd only been with the company for a little over a decade, he was promoted to be vice chairman. And then by the end of 1975, he was promoted to be our chairman and CEO. So that's so just think about what you were doing in 1975. I'm not going to share Mr. Holland's age, but I will tell you that I was halfway through kindergarten when he took over as the chairman and CEO of Fruit of the Loom, which is pretty amazing. So another really kind of neat thing happened with Fruit of the Loom and Union Underwear that year, and that is we developed a TV ad, and we had these guys dressed in fruit costumes, and they were shown kind of in the label of the back label of a white brief. You can see a small picture of it up here in the, on this slide, and these guys were talking. And I don't know that we quite knew what we were doing at that moment, but these guys took off in a big way. And today we call them the Fruit Guys. They've become some of the most iconic brand ambassadors in the history of advertising, and that first ad was in 1975. So just to bring us along our timeline a little bit, in 1980, the decision was made to actually locate the world headquarters here in Bowling Green. So we had this big Church Street facility. A lot of the sales and marketing activity for Union Underwear and then Fruit of the Loom was actually being managed at that time up in New York. But the decision was made to move everybody to Bowling Green, build the office that we're operating in today. That was built in 1981, and that's truly when the company kind of came together in that moment. In 1985, there's a gentleman by the name of Bill Farley who actually acquired Northwest Industries. And as part of that, again, there were a lot of different companies that were associated with Northwest Industries. He spent the next 2 years divesting Northwest Industries of a lot of their different entities and really started to put his focus on Fruit of the Loom and Acme Boots. Mr. Holland continued to be the president and chief operating officer of Union Underwear during this period, and Mr. Holland actually stayed on in that role until 1996. During that period, the company surpassed $1 billion in sales in 1988, and then just a few years later, in 1994, surpassed the $2 billion mark. So during the kind of the late 80s and early 90s, the company was on a real growth trajectory. Part of that was through acquisitions. There were brands like Gaetano Jeans and Pro Player that were becoming part of the Fruit of the Loom family, but there was a real kind of strong growth path during that period. So in 1996, Mr. Holland retired, and Bill Farley was kind of in a position. So he was the CEO of what was known as Northwest Industries and became Farley Industries. He appointed himself to also be the president, chief operating officer of Fruit of the Loom. So it's, I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to work for yourself before, but I'm not quite sure how that works. I do know that it kind of led us into a little bit of a dark period for our company. And again, that was in the 1995-1996 period. So let me kind of move on to, and I know the print's kind of small, but you can see that John Holland retired briefly in 1996, because it's not the end of the John Holland story. So what did that lead to? That leads to what I'm going to describe as the Berkshire Hathaway era, and we're within that era, within our company's history right now. So in 1991, the company, excuse me, 1999, the company had to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and you know, any bankruptcy story is a complicated story, and it's not one that I'm prepared to get into tonight, but we'll just say that we were kind of upside down. Obviously, we were not generating enough revenue to cover our costs, and just had a lot of challenges through the late 90s. We went into bankruptcy, and the folks that were trying to manage the company through bankruptcy did a really smart thing. They asked Mr. Holland to come back. He had been retired for about 4 years. I never asked him whether he was enjoying retirement or not, but I would assume, you know, retirement sounds like kind of a good thing. And I will tell you, one of the best things to ever happen to our company is his decision to say yes and kind of come back and guide us through the bankruptcy period. He was able to organize a deal with Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, and we came out of bankruptcy when Mr. Buffett bought the company in 2002, and we became a wholly owned subsidiary of Berkshire Hathaway, which we're still proud of being today. So this is what this has done is now for, you know, almost 12 years, 13 years, it's given us a sense of kind of financial peace. It's allowed us to invest in our products and our brands, and it's allowed us to kind of spend the last 10 years really building a much stronger company than what we were when we went through, when we went into the bankruptcy period. So after Berkshire Hathaway purchased us, we were in a position to acquire some other companies. So in 2006, we purchased the Russell brands, which includes brands like Russell Athletic and Spalding. And then a year later, we purchased the Vanity Fair Intimate Apparel brands, which includes brands like Vanity Fair and Curvation and Vacherette. So today, we're much more than just this one brand. We're really a collection of brands, and we manage the company in a lot of different ways, but at the same time, we're still kind of very, very true to understanding what we can be the best in the world at, and we try to honor that every day we come to work. So the second retirement for Mr. Holland happened in 2010, and Rick Medlin, who's our current president and CEO, took over the CEO position for us. So if you think about it, with Mr. Holland, 1961 to 2010, almost 50 years that he served our company, and very close to the same kind of tenure that the Jag Goldfarb had from the start. So we've had the fortune of having really kind of stable leadership for most of our history at the top, and I think as we kind of get through the John Holland and into the Berkshire Hathaway years, certainly Mr. Holland's signature is kind of all over who we are today. Okay. So any questions? My biggest fear in pulling this together, because I told you how his mind is like a steel trap, is that he might show up here tonight, and which would have been awesome, but the fact checking would have been much more intense as well. So, okay, so I'm going to shift gears for a second and kind of put on my marketing hat and talk to you a little bit about the Fruitland brand. So how are we doing on time? Okay. So just a couple of kind of entry notes. So since 1851, you'll hear us claim since 1851 when we talk about our brand. Well, that in fact was the year that Robert Knight started his company when he purchased the Potomac Mill up in Warwick, Rhode Island. Brian, I don't know if you remember, you mentioned that I graduated from West Warwick High School. I didn't know it at the time, but literally one of the Knight Brothers facilities was just down the street from the high school I went to, from where I grew up. So it's kind of funny how those things kind of turn full circle. But he started this company in 1851, and kind of an interesting story on how the brand was born. One of his customers was a merchant named Rufus Skeel, and he was in the kind of the Hudson Bay area of New York, and he purchased a lot of fabric at the time. And he was looking for a way to distinguish this product that he bought from the Knight Brothers from all the other product or from the other fabric. And his daughter would paint these really nice pictures of fruit. And so what he decided to do is he would take these cards with these pictures of fruit and he would paste them to the fabric from the Knight Brothers. And they kind of coined the term the fruit of the loom. And this was a way to distinguish this finer quality fabric from a lot of the other fabric that was available in his store. And thus, our brand was born. So that's the earliest kind of sightings that we have of the Fruit of the Loom brand, all the way back to 1856. A little more formally, the U.S. Patent and U.S. Patent and Trademark Office opened in July of 1870, and the Knight Brothers were one of the first guys there to try to get this mark registered. We were given registration number 220. So yeah, I actually looked on Wikipedia today, and the number of registered trademarks today exceeds somewhere up north of 100 million. So think about it. Fruit of the Loom has trademark number 220. You know, we know it's older than Coke. We know that it's older than Levi Strauss. We certainly think it's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, apparel mark, and we think that it could potentially be one of the oldest brands ever. So this whole notion of branding, and people didn't call it that back then, but when this girl took this picture of fruit and put it on sheets, that's kind of, I don't know that we invented branding, but we kind of like to think that maybe we had a big hand in it. But that's where it started. So initially it was with individual fruits like this apple that you can see on the screen. The first cluster that we're aware of was where we had multiple fruits with the apple and the grapes and the currants, or what we'll call gooseberries. We have visibility of that kind of making its way into the market in 1877. And then We didn't have television back then to really go out and promote our brand, but we had the World's Fair. So in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair, the Knight Brothers had quite an elaborate booth. You can see a small picture of it on the screen. And our sense is that's really when all of America started to get a sense of what this Fruit of the Loom brand was all about. So a brand was born. As the brand continued to progress, what we liked about our history is there was actually a series of firsts. There was kind of a pioneering spirit to how Fruit of the Loom approached the market. The first was in 1911. We were the first brand to be out there with an unconditional guarantee, where we were guaranteed to give you your money back or replace your product if you weren't completely satisfied. That was not a common thing to do back then. A lot of brands and a lot of products do that today, but in 1911 that wasn't the case. And what was interesting is part of the reason we introduced this unconditional guarantee was because at the time cotton prices were starting to fall, and what the Knight Brothers were trying to do was protect their price in the market. So instead of lowering their price, they offered this unconditional guarantee, and it gave them some price protection as they went to market. Other first is in 1939, Jack Goldfarb with Union Underwear created the first kind of professional sales force within our industry. Before that, sales were kind of done out of the individual mills, so he actually created a national sales force, and it's a model that we still have today. So we felt like that was a first. In 1940, much to the chagrin of much of the market, we were actually the first ones to take multiple garments and put them in one package. So this particular package was a three-pack. Depending on what category, whether you're looking at women's underwear or men's underwear, you can find pack sizes as large as 12 out there right now. And that's how we're able to kind of market a value. But we were the first ones. Before that, garments were sold individually, just kind of laying on a table. So we figured out a way to kind of bundle these together and merchandise them in a different way. And then from an advertising perspective, back in 1953 on the Today Show, does anybody remember the host of the Today Show back in 1953? Is it Dan Galloway?
Dave Galloway.
Dave Galloway. So we were on the Today Show with Dave Galloway, and that was the first time that underwear was promoted or advertised in a TV setting. And then in 1988, we actually, this sounds kind of risque, but we actually showed a woman in her underwear in a TV commercial, which hadn't been done before that. So it's not that we were trying to be like risque in any way, but if you think about it, if you're in the underwear business and you're trying to sell more of it, you got to figure out a way to kind of get out there and promote it. So certainly being able to advertise underwear is something that we've done a lot of, and our competitors as well, but we really kind of felt like we were one of the pioneers in how we approached that advertising. So a history of first, and we're continuing to try to be first to market in a lot of different ways today. But with everything that we've done, and this was kind of a nice discovery as we went through and prepared this presentation, a lot of branding is about consistency, and you know what you're trying to do is you're trying to build trust with your consumer base, so they have to understand where you're coming from. And what I think is interesting is whether you look at what Jack Goldfarb said back in 1926 when he said, "I want to create the best for the least," we talk about it a little differently today. I've got a little slide up here that shows what our brand promise is. If somebody would ask you, what's the Fruit of the Loom brand promise, it's two words. It's surprising value. And our goal is to take these three elements, iconic design, and great quality, and a great price, and if we can find the right combination of those three ingredients, our hope is that you buy our product and say, wow, this is really great stuff, and I can't believe it's at such a great price. Thus the surprise, surprising value. So that's something that we try to adhere to with everything we do with the Fruit of the Loom brand. But again, it's not unlike what Jack Goldfarb was trying to do when he started the company back in 1926. Okay. Just so you guys don't have to listen to me talk the whole time. So I've actually kind of queued up a few commercials. And what I wanted to, when we talk about this consistency of message, I'm going to play a few spots for you. The first one is from 1960. The second one's from 1979. And then the third one is from 2010. None of these are part of our current campaign that Brian was mentioning earlier. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about our current campaign here in just a minute. But I hope you guys enjoy just a little bit of a walk down memory lane. Again, look for the consistency with how these three are presented. I'm going to throw out kind of two more kind of trivia questions. In one of these three spots, there's an Academy Award winner. And I'll kind of help you out a little bit. He's actually in the second spot, and I'll tell you who he is and what he won an Academy Award for not too long after he did this commercial for us. So let me run through these, okay?
If you want to know about men's underwear, ask a woman.
I wouldn't buy my man any underwear that didn't have this, a waist that stretches when he does, and room to move in, leg room, seat room. Otherwise, he just wouldn't wear it. I like the sunrise cotton wash and wear. No irony. The price? 79 cents. Even less for our boys' t-shirts and briefs. 59 cents. We could afford to pay more, but why should we? We get what we want from Fruit of the Loom. Same goes for shirts. Imagine style like this for only $2.99. And new permanent pressed dress shirts, only $3.99. With Fruit of the Loom, we save money to buy some of the other things we've always wanted.
The price is so low.
The value is so high.
You can't afford not to buy Fruit of the Loom.
So do you see the brand promise? So again, that was from 1960. My trivia question, I think, was kind of challenging, so I'm going to kind of hone in a little bit. So I will tell you that this Academy Award winner that I mentioned is, he will be in the Leaf costume in this next spot. So note that. I'll tell you who he is afterwards. And also pay particular attention to the price for the white brief that Miss Emma talks about at the end of this spot. Okay?
Does
anybody know who was in the Leaf costume? Okay, I didn't know either until I kind of dug into it, but his name is F. Murray Abraham, and he won the Academy Award for Best Actor back in 1984 for his role in Amadeus. So just a few years before that, he was working for us and doing a fine job. Anybody catch the price of that white brief? $1.23. So I'll help you out on this one too. So I went on Walmart.com this afternoon, and I looked for that same product. And today we sell it in a 7-pack. So the price for a 7-pack of those white briefs, 2015, is $8. So $8 divided by 7 is $1.14. So this commercial is, well over 30 years old. And for that particular item, you'll pay a little bit more for some of the other styles that like our boxer briefs and our boxers. But for that basic white brief, it's actually cheaper to buy it today than it was back in 1979. So, I think that speaks to kind of the competitive nature of our market. Our company has spent a lot of time over the last few years trying to be very, very kind of creative and trying to figure out how to still run a profitable business, despite the fact, and we're all guilty of it. We all like lower prices, and as easy as it may sound to say, okay, let's just go kind of triple our price and keep up with the consumer pricing index, that's not what people are willing to pay today. So it really creates quite a business challenge, but one that we've been able to figure out. But I thought you might find that interesting. Cheaper today than 1979. So the Fruit Guys, this was an earlier one. So they were introduced in 75. This was a spot from 79. What I want to do is show you one of the later spots. This is from 2010, and it speaks to one of our kind of our key selling categories, which is back to school. We always want our consumers to think about a fresh pack of underwear the same way they do pencils and notebooks as a back to school supply.
Fruit of the Loom is a vital school supply. Won't cost you much, and if you care, you're gonna look for your own fly.
So the fruit guys, you know, back from the kind of the, actually throughout the 2000s all the way up to 2010, 2011, continued to be that ambassador for us and the primary spokesperson for us within our commercials. We took a little bit of a different course here over the last few years, and it's with our new campaign, and it's called Start Happy. Brian described this a little bit earlier. Instead of me kind of describing or kind of repeating what Brian had said earlier, we've got a little video here, and it's about 3 minutes. And it really, this is not a commercial. It's not something that that you're ever going to see on television, but it is something that we actually pulled together to really help our internal team understand what this brand is all about. And it's intended to affect the way not just that we communicate about our brand, but the way that we think about our product, the way that we go to business every day. And this is our Start Happy manifesto.
The morning is a powerful thing. It can set the tone for the entire day. And nothing is more powerful than the first thing you put on. A wrong choice can make you feel like you woke up on the wrong side of bed. But something like the right pair of underwear can make you feel like you can do anything. For over 160 years, our designers, innovators, and all-around go-doers wake up every day with a belief in the relentless pursuit of better. Making underwear and outerwear with a fit that doesn't quit. Every boxer, panty, and hoodie is made to make sure America can express their true colors while wearing it. We even guarantee it, because we believe when you start your day looking on the bright side, you can't lose. And who knows, you might make someone else's day a little brighter too. In 2013, Fruity Balloons set out on a mission to encourage America put on the power of positive underwear one leg at a time. We showed that the right pair can make you feel like you can do anything. We asked America to start happy. The Start Happy campaign began with Fresh Gigs, one of the first times a brand has ever partnered with LinkedIn. If a user just landed a new job and updated their employment status, we surprised them with some fresh Fruit of the Loom undies, making sure they started their new gig on the right foot. Then, with our TV spots featuring a stunt woman and a pit crew, we showed that when you start happy with Fruit of the Loom, you can take on any job. And we didn't stop there. All across America, people were introduced to the power of positive underwear. Next, Fruit of the Loom created a limited edition of legitimately lucky underwear, Lucky Looms. We not only got in people's top drawers, we got into their heads and hearts, helping America start happy. And soon, the press took notice. This year, we're taking Fruit of the Loom to the next level. With the launch of the completely reinvented boxer briefs and cotton panties, we created no ride-up legs and extra soft fabric to unleash even more positivity. We changed our underwear, and it's time for America to do the same. TV spots will spark this change, running online and during national primetime sports and cable.
Now these guys woke up ready to swing for the fences. They must have switched to those new Fruit of the Loom boxer briefs with no ride-up legs. Now that's a whole new ball.
We'll continue to weave this reinvention story into everything we do, from retail to advertising, social media, and even in Times Square. Sure, we know exactly what's stitched into our clothing, but people will realize that our fabric is made of more than that. This year, we're unleashing the power of optimism through everything we make and everything we do, becoming wearable proof of what's possible when you have the right start. Through the wind. Start happy.
So it was the Start Happy campaign actually came from a piece of research, and we talked with a lot of consumers, and what we found is that underwear is kind of one of those things that you don't really think about unless something's not working right. We talk about comfort being the absence of discomfort, But what we found is that that when something's not going right, it really can have an impact on your day and can put you in a bad mood and all kinds of stuff. So what we try to do is kind of flip that around and say, you know what, by picking our product and picking a better product, then we truly can make your day better. We can help you kind of take on the day in a much more positive way. So that was the whole notion of Start Happy, and really just to get consumers to think about our product when they're doing, you know, just like when you're brushing your teeth every morning, think about the product that you're putting on. So that was the genesis behind Start Happy. You know, what's different today, and you guys can appreciate this, it's not just about running TV commercials anymore. So these partnerships with LinkedIn, this Lucky Looms piece that they talked about, which, I mean, those were legitimately lucky underwear. And if you want to learn more about that, you can go on our website and see how we truly made them lucky. But those are ways that you kind of engage consumers with your brand in the modern age. And that's something that we're proud of with this particular campaign. I told Chrissy last night, my wife, that maybe I have too many commercials in here. And she said, you can never have too many commercials. So I'm just going to show you two more. These are our latest two. One ran this past holiday. And then if anybody watched any of the basketball during March Madness, you may have seen this latest spot featuring that no write-up boxer brief I mentioned earlier. So these are our last two commercials, and then we'll wrap it up.
There are some people you should give underwear to this holiday. And there are some people you shouldn't. People you shouldn't.
Dennis!
Should. No. Nope. Nah, you shouldn't give underwear to everybody, but for those you do, get
them. Now, I like the way you work it. I like the bag it. I like the way you work it. I like the bag it. I like the way you work it.
Music.
Oh, sorry.
No write-up boxer briefs. We tested them, so you know they work.
We've actually had some legitimate requests for those plastic pants, and that's not something that we're in production with. So just a little bit about us today. So as I mentioned earlier, we're no longer just one brand. We're actually a pretty broad portfolio of brands. We actually employ over 31,000 people around the globe, and we're operating in over 200 countries. We own over 40 of our own facilities, and we're employing almost 2,000 people right here in Bowling Green. So we're quite a bit larger than maybe those early days of Jack Goldfarb. And we do have market leadership in several categories, not just with the Fruit of the Loom brand, but Spalding within the basketball arena and Russell Athletic. And then Vanity Fair is our top women's bra brand. We've had a real focus on corporate social responsibility, and a lot of companies talk about this these days, but this is something we've been focused on since day one, maybe since the days we first started offering free milk at that Franklin facility. And what was nice is we got a lot of credit for it last year. So a lot of the work that we've done in the way of labor relations around the world, a lot of the work that we've done with our sustainable energy practices, led to us receiving the State Department's ACE Award, and ACE stands for Award in Corporate Excellence, and this is something that we were awarded last year, really only one of three companies to actually receive the ACE Award. So you'll see a picture here of our current president, CEO Rick Medlin, receiving the award from the Secretary of State, John Kerry. So again, this is not something that you'll see us out kind of promoting every day, but it was nice to finally get some recognition for doing business the right way, and certainly something that we're proud of. And I couldn't do a presentation on our company without putting a plug in for our brand shop. We opened a store right over on Scottsville Road a little over 3 years ago. It was in October of 2011, and we're really proud of this store. We work hard to make sure that we've got kind of a full assortment of everything that we offer as a company, so you'll see this kind of breadth of brands and breadth of product when you walk in. Because you guys have been such a nice audience this evening, I've got some discount cards I'm going to give you when the presentation's over, and I just encourage you to stop by and pay our brand shop a visit. We would love to see you. And that is the end of the presentation. So on behalf of everybody at Fruit of the Loom, again, thank you for taking an interest in our company. Thanks for being part of this community that gives us a great place to work and raise our families day in and day out. So thanks for the invitation.
I think we have time for questions. Yes,
please.
So Fruit of the Loom essentially started like vertically integrated and then sort of become more horizontal over time, or by acquiring these brands versus having the way they started out, but with, you know, producing their inputs.
Yeah, it's a great question. A big part of our operation is still vertical, but a little bit of the shift that we've made over the last few years is that we're not going to make just the stuff that we can make ourselves. You know, we've really put a lot of effort into to building out our sourcing capability, and we have the ability to go really anywhere in the world now. And if it's product that really what we want to focus on is make sure that we're developing product that consumers want, and being able to take new product to the market, like this No Write-Up Boxer Brief, you know, it sounds pretty straightforward, but we learned that was an issue in the marketplace by talking to consumers and saying, you know, what bugs you about boxer briefs? And they said, well, when they kind of ride up my legs. So we were able to take that consumer insight and go develop the right product. That's one that we do have the ability to do ourselves. But if we feel like there's something that's core to our brand and right for the consumer, then we'll figure out how to make it. So we're kind of a combination of both that vertical manufacturer, but also a sourcing operation that can go out and work with other partners to bring the right product to market. Good question.
You've talked about this new advertising campaign. Is fashion become more important than price, or is there a right balance between fashion and price? And a lot of underwear companies that didn't used to be around today.
Yeah, it's fashion absolutely matters, and what's interesting is if you look at our product, you know, you can walk into Target right after this meeting, and you'll see 12 feet of Fruit of the Loom underwear space in the men's section. You'll see the same thing from Hanes, and you know, I would say with the two kind of mass brands, if you will, meaning Fruit and Hanes, we actually offer more color and fashion and assortment than just about any other brand out there. But you know, these are brands that are sold at Walmart and Target, so that value component is still critical. And you know, what we've had to work to do is try to find that right combination. But certainly, if we were just leaning on price and not engaging a lot of the fashion elements that are hitting the market, we would be losing share. So it's that the fashion component has become important to our business.
Comment, Scott. I'm probably the only man in this room who was able to wear your side tie button front shorts.
You said it better than I did.
And I appreciated them. They did ride up, so I'm glad.
I've always wondered if they were comfortable or not, so I'm glad we've gotten better with that. I thought you were going to tell me you wore the union suit. I really had some questions on that one. So.
Back here, yes. Someone over here?
Oh, yes. I did have a question.
Sure.
I just noticed how you said that you all had many brands that were like the number one market leader. Just wondering how that was like on a global presence. Are you also like a global leader with like the Spalding, the Russell brands, and all of that?
Yeah, we've got a lot of our effort these days we're truly becoming a global company. And as I mentioned earlier, we have a footprint, whether through our operations, our distribution, in a lot of countries. That leadership term, I think where I would claim kind of leadership is in Europe, actually in the activewear market. So what we describe as activewear are all of these T-shirts that are sold through wholesalers and then printed with all kinds of different screen prints. We have a significant leadership position in the activewear category in Europe. And Spalding is a very global brand for us. So because of our affiliation with the NBA, the Spalding brand is very, very popular in China and other parts of the world. But from a leadership position, the Fruit of the Loom brand in Europe in that activewear segment is really strong.
If you go to your website, I notice it's done by continent. So does the same Fruit of the Loom underwear that appears in Walmart and Bowling Green sold in London, and or are they different?
They're different. And we we tried that when we were entering the Chinese market a few years ago. We kind of had this sense that we should know more about underwear than anybody else in the world, so let's take this product that we make in America and see if the Chinese market likes it. And they didn't particularly care for it. It wasn't sized correctly for them. They were looking for different features. So as we continue to expand globally, it's forcing us to be a little more customized in how we make our product for each of these different markets.
Yeah, right here.
You partially answered this, but when the company first started, did they have designers, or was it like the people at the machine saying, oh, this is really stupid, this isn't going to work, but my husband is complaining. Do you think that we could do this? And so do you have a history of background, how this these styles generated in changing styles?
Yeah, it's I think certainly in the very early years, it was definitely a smaller group that was very hands-on, kind of right there on the factory floor. My sense is developing product through a lot of trial and error. So we have a pretty extensive design and merchandising group today. I don't know when that specific specialization or that specific function really kind of worked its way into the company. But my sense is in those early days that the design aspects were not quite as sophisticated as they are today. I don't know, Lacey, do you have any insight on that? Yeah. There's historically in our industry, a lot of the fitting is done on a mannequin, but I do know over the last few years we work really hard. We actually fit all of our product not on mannequins, but we have a range of, as we all know, we're all built differently, a lot of different body sizes. So we spend a lot of time with fit models to make sure that we're getting our product exactly as it needs to be.
Because I'm 90 years old, it used to be that we didn't have washing machines, so I have washed every style you have, and it hung on I kept wondering, who in the heck designed this? It takes me 90 years to find out.
We have time for one more question, maybe.
When you Fruit of the Loom had underwear, that brand?
Yeah, it's a good. Lacey, do you know the date on the women's side?
Fruit of the Loom licensed their brand to women's underwear as early as the 1930s, but Union Underwear did not produce Fruit of the Loom underwear.
Okay. Aren't you glad Lacey showed up tonight?
Well, on that note, I think we'll stop for, I know some people have commitments, we'll stop and do our door prize. And again, thank you especially for coming out.
Thanks, Brian.